The Christian proverb is that man's extremity is God's opportunity. And so people, in other words, have to get desperate. Imagine the idea that the moment you were born, you were kicked off the edge of a precipice and you're falling. As you fell, a great lump of rock came with you and is traveling alongside you. And you're clinging to it for dear life and thinking, gee, I've got to hold on to this, you see? Well, it doesn't do a thing for you. And it's only making you anxious. And it's only when you understand that it doesn't do a thing for you that you let go and relax. So everybody's in this situation. We're all completely insecure. We're all headed straight for death as if we had been condemned by a judge. And yet here we are all clinging on to things. And we have all sorts of alibis for doing this. We say, well, I have responsibilities for my dependents and I've got to cling on. But all you're doing is you're teaching your dependents to cling the same way as you are. And making them miserable by learning to go on surviving compulsively. So the thing is, same way, if you're caught in a torrent and you try to get out of it by swimming against it, you'll just wear yourself out and you're still carried along with it. So the sensible thing to do is to turn around and swim with it. And if you want to get out of it, swim towards the edge. But go with it. Same way when you're sailing, always keep the wind in your sails. If you want to go against the wind, tack. But use the wind. So it's this way, you know. We're all in this great stream of change, which we call life. We are the stream. If you imagine you're separate from it and you're being carried along by it as if you were a cork, that's a delusion. You're a wave of the stream itself. So get with it. So you perform a discipline by experiment, by reductio ad absurdum of his premises. And so in the same way, the guru, whether Hindu or Buddhist, performs a reductio ad absurdum on the premise of the skin-encapsulated ego. Well, what happens then? You might imagine from garbled accounts of Eastern mysticism that one thereupon disappears forever into an infinite sea of faintly mauve jello. And become so lost to the world and entranced that you forget your name, address, telephone number, and function in life. And nothing of the kind happens. The state of mystical illumination, although it may in its sudden onset be accompanied by a sensation of tremendous luminescence and transparency, as you get used to it, it's just like everyday life. Here are the things that you formerly thought were separate individuals. And here is you, who you formerly thought was merely confronting these other people. When the great Dr. D.T. Suzuki was asked, what is it like to be enlightened? He said, it's just like ordinary everyday experience, except about 2 inches off the ground. Because what is altered is not the way your senses perceive. What is altered is what you think about it. Your definitions of what you see, your evaluation of it. So when you don't cling to it, when you have no longer a hostile attitude to the world because you know the world is you, it is. I mean, let's take it from the point of view of biology. If I describe the behavior of a living organism, I cannot possibly describe that behavior without simultaneously describing the behavior of the environment. So that I discover that I don't describe organisms in environments, I describe a unified field of behavior called an organism environment. It's an awkward word. But there it is. The environment doesn't push the organism around. The organism doesn't push the environment around. They are two aspects or poles of the same process.
see, in the history of philosophy and poetry and art, we always find the interchange of two personality types, which I call prickles and goo. The prickly people are advocates of intellectual porcupinism. They want a rigor. They want precise statistics. And they have a certain clipped attitude in their voices. And you know this very well in academic circles, where there are people who are always edgy like that. And they accuse other people of being disgustingly vague and miasmic and mystical. But the vague, miasmic, and mystical people accuse the prickly people of being mere skeletons with no flesh on their bones. And they say to you, you just rattle. You're not really a human being. You know the words, but you don't know the music. And so therefore, if you belong to the prickly type, you hope that the ultimate constituent of matter is particles. If you belong to the gooey type, you hope it's waves. If you are prickly, you're a classicist. And if you're gooey, you're a romanticist. And going back into medieval philosophy, if you're prickly, you're a nominalist. If you're gooey, you're a realist. And so it goes. But we know very well that this natural universe is neither prickles nor goo exclusively. It's gooey prickles and prickly goo. And you see, it all depends on your level of magnification. If you've got your magnification on something so that the focus is clear, you've got a prickly point of view. You've got structure, shape, clearly outlined, sharply defined. You're a little out of focus, it's going to go bleh, and you've got goo. But we're always playing with the two, because it's like the question is the world basically stuff, like matter, or is it basically structure? Well, we find out, of course, today that in science we don't consider the idea of matter, of there being some sort of stuff, because supposing you wanted to describe stuff, in what terms would you describe it? You always have to describe it in terms of structure, something countable, something that can be designated as a pattern. So we never get to any basic stuff. There is a sense in which the universe is purely game, but not in the sense of a one-upmanship game, but in the sense of music, which is lulling with sound, is dancing delightfully with sound, you see. And nobody was ever able to give a better account of what it's all about. I mean, let's take the traditional Christian account of what the angels do in heaven. Why, they sit around the throne of God and sing Alleluia, 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 and they're going, you know, so that's not just Alleluia in a sort of formal way, but they're going, no, they're really swinging. And by the time you know where they are, the swinging has reached such fantastic proportions. And they've thought out the most amazing little goody-doody-doody-doody-doos that you've got the whole physical universe happening. Yeah, that's the way it starts. And so, I mean, this game is great. In music, though, one doesn't make the end of a composition the point of the composition. If that were so, the best conductors would be those who played fastest. And there would be composers who wrote only finales. People go to a concert just to hear one crashing chord, because that's the end. Same way in dancing. You don't aim at a particular spot in the room. That's where you should arrive. The whole point of the dancing is the dance. Now, but we don't see that as something brought by our education into our everyday conduct. We've got a system of schooling which gives a completely different impression. It's all graded. And what we do is we put the child into the corridor of this grade system with a kind of, come on, kitty, kitty, kitty.
And yeah, you go to kindergarten, you know, and that's a great thing because when you finish that, you'll get into first grade. And then, come on, first grade leads to second grade and so on, and then you get out of grade school, and you've got high school, and it's revving up, the thing is coming. Then you're going to go to college, and by Jove, then you get into graduate school, and when you're through with graduate school, you go out to join the world. And then you get into some racket where you're selling insurance, and they've got that quota to make. And you're going to make that. And all the time, the thing is coming. It's coming. It's coming. That great thing, the success you're working for. Then when you wake up one day about 40 years old, you say, my God, I've arrived. I'm there. And you don't feel very different from what you always felt. And there's a slight letdown because you feel there's a hoax. And there was a hoax. A dreadful hoax. They made you miss everything. We thought of life by analogy with a journey. With a pilgrimage, which had a serious purpose at the end, and the thing was to get to that end, success or whatever it is, or maybe heaven after you're dead. But we missed the point the whole way along. It was a musical thing, and you were supposed to sing or to dance while the music was being played.
Why do we love nonsense? Why do we love Lewis Carroll? With his 'twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe, all mimsy were the borogoves and the mome raths outgrabe. Why is it that all those old English songs are full of fal-de-riddle ido and hey nonny nonny and all those babbling choruses? Why is it that when we get hep with jazz, we just go boody boody boopty boo and so on and enjoy ourselves swinging it? It is this participation in the essential, glorious nonsense that is at the heart of the world, that isn't going anywhere, that is a dance. But it seems that only in moments of unusual insight and illumination that we get the point of this, and find that thus the true meaning of life is no meaning, that its purpose is no purpose, and that its sense is nonsense.
Been listening to Alan Watts from the Spoken Word Library of the Electronic University. For copies of this and other Alan Watts programs, please go to alanwatts.com on the World Wide Web or call us toll-free at 1-800-WO-WATTS. That's ALANWATTS.com or 1-800-WO-WATTS. The Watts website features free audio downloads, program lists, and information on Watts' life and works. Once again, that's alanwatts.com or 1-800-WO-WATTS.